I'm Carrie Miller, now in depth on the way we eat and why it should change. Dan Barber's new book created a lot of buzz, but it didn't pop up on my dashboard until a roundtabler and food innovator mentioned it when I asked him what he was reading.
I'm actually reading Dan Barber's new book, The Third Plate. And he's going back that and saying, look, we have cherry-picked these people. We love this idea of finding these wonderful things, that this emmer wheat, for example, that he talks about, that these farmers are growing. But where we don't appreciate the fact that they had to leave half of their field fallow in order to accomplish that in a sustainable way, or that they had to grow kidney beans that they're going to basically sell at a loss. And so that in order to actually do this right, we have to appreciate the entire system.
So here we are, and I'm glad Mr. Barber could make time for the conversation. Dan is advocating for a food system that's much more accommodating of the environment than demanding of it. He writes in his introduction that for all of the influence of the farm-to-table movement, quote, the gains haven't changed in any fundamental way the political and economic forces shaping how most of the food in this country is grown or raised. So why not? As Dan Barber joins us, I'd like to know if the way you eat has changed significantly as a result of the availability and accessibility to local farms. Are you not only eating more local, are you eating more sustainably, or think you are? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. We've got a discussion going on the Daily Circuit page, and I'm on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Dan Barber is the executive chef and co-owner of Blue Hill Restaurant in Manhattan and Blue Hill at Stone Barns, outside of New York City. The new book is called The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. He's with us from New York City. And Dan, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks, Carrie. Great to be here.
You know, I think your concept needs to be explained, I think, here. And perhaps the way to do this is this wonderful description that you have of your eight-row Flint polenta. Can you explain the ingredients and then how it fits into this idea of the third plate?
The eight-row Flint polenta is a very old variety of corn that Native Americans celebrated. Eight-row Flint especially was celebrated in the Hudson Valley, where I am in the lower Hudson Valley, and a seed philanthropist sent me the seed 10 years ago. And he accompanied the it was a seed. It was a corn cob. It was the eight-row Flint corn cob. And he offered $2,000 if we were to plant the eight-row Flint corn on the farm. And his goal was to get more people interested in eight-row Flint and celebrating these old world flavors of this corn. And I had very little interest in it. And the farmer at Stone Barns had very little interest in growing corn. But for the $2,000, he invested he cashed the check and planted it. And we ended up having a kind of revelatory experience in the kitchen, because I remember the day that he harvested the corn and then he dried it and he brought it in, and I made a very simple polenta out of water and salt and a tiny bit of butter, although it turned out I really didn't need it. And as it was cooking, I was thrown right back into the middle of August, sort of like chainsawing through a sweet corn cob. I mean, it had all these flavors and depth of taste that I had never experienced in polenta. And one of the reasons clearly was this variety that had been lost in this country. And another reason was that we were fresh milling it. So before I was cooking it on the stovetop, we milled it to order. And we milled it to order because it came in as dried corn and we had to mill it. And I was used to buying very, exceptionally good polenta, but that had already been ground. And when you buy pre-ground polenta, you're buying polenta that has its germ removed. And when you remove the germ, you make it shelf stable. The germ only represents about 5% of that corn kernel, but it's a very important 5%, which gives you a lot of nutrition and where most of the flavor is. So I experienced this corn in a whole different way, and it sort of kickstarted my interest in grains and in fresh milling and in looking at a large percentage of our diet and correspondingly a very large percentage of our agricultural landscape and how we might rethink it for the future.
Yeah, so I think the revelation clearly of taste of this corn and what you made of it, but also, as you say, it sets you on the path to this idea of the difference. I guess the way I think about it, the difference between accommodating our food system and demanding of it, right? Even in the most sustainable way, right?
Yeah, right. And sustainability wasn't the driver here. It was flavor and taste. And I think what I kept coming back to in the research for this book over the 10 years that I wrote the book, that in my quest for great flavor, truly great flavor, you end up by definition forcing the right kind of farming, because you can't get the flavors that you want or that I became introduced to without the right kind of stewardship on the lamb and on the land. And that, to a certain extent, we all know that. I mean, a great tasting carrot can't come from denuded soils, or a truly delicious leg of lamb doesn't come from grain-fed, confined sheep. I mean, it makes sense. But when you carry it through, you see, I learned again and again and again that to follow, to be greedy, to be demanding of these exceptional flavors was to steward a landscape that is sustainable and actually improves the landscape, which I found the ultimate lesson of the book, which is the ultimate lesson, I think, of this movement, which is that agriculture is disruptive of a natural system. But if we do it right, if we do it elegantly, or we do it thoughtfully, and we do it with the focus on flavor and nutrition, we end up prescribing a future that will feed a lot of people and do it deliciously and nutritionally.
Yeah, you talk about the idea of what the farm-to-table movement kind of started with, the ideal at the center of that, and you say it's direct and connected. Yeah, that sounds right. And then you add, but really, the farmer ends up servicing the table, not the other way around. Think of some other examples, can you, to explain this?
Well, I can think of examples of this morning at the farmer's market. I spent an hour and a half going through getting everything together for the two restaurants. The Wednesday is a big farmer's market in at Union Square in the middle of Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And while, this is we're in late in July and we're coming into the height of the summer season, so there's quite a lot of diversity and tonnage. I mean, it really is a full market right now. But the truth is that much of what's at the stalls are products that farmers know they're going to be able to sell. So these are the cream crops. When I say cream crops, I'm talking about tomatoes. I'm talking about peas. I'm talking about zucchini, string beans. These are all crops that require a tremendous amount of time in the field, labor, but they also require a tremendous amount of soil fertility. They are extractive of soil fertility. You know, we are taught, we learn we are told anyway to eat more vegetables, and we learn to do that because it's more nutritious for us. We are often not told that those vegetables require a tremendous amount of nutrition from the soil. And mm-hmm. if you think of soil as a bank account, every time we support and celebrate those vegetables, we're also withdrawing from a farm somewhere quite a bit of fertility. We're drawing from the bank account. And what we need to do, and what farmers know intimately, intuitively and intimately, is that they need to pay back the bank. And they do that through compost, Organic farmers do it through compost. They also do it through negotiating a rotation schedule of vegetables and fruits and grains, where certain crops break up disease cycles and other crops provide certain types of fertility to the soil. And what I'm arguing for in the third plate is an understanding on our part, on the eater's part, on the chef's part, to become better connected to these, to this nuts and bolts of farming, and recognize that what we see at the farmer's market, while making those purchases important and, as you mentioned, direct and connected, we also should recognize that it doesn't represent the entirety of the farm. The whole farm cooking means supporting less coveted grains and fruits. So, for example, if you look at a large grain farm, which you have many in Minnesota, if we were to support wheat, for example, we should also be supporting those crops that the wheat farmer is required to grow to get the fertility necessary in the soil to grow good wheat. So what are those crops? Barley, buckwheat, millet, leguminous crops like Austrian winter peas, kidney beans were mentioned earlier. Any beans are leguminous crops. It means they take nitrogen from the air and they trap it in the soil and they feed soil nutrients, the much needed nitrogen. So if we want to support, if we want to celebrate local wheat, for example, we ought to be celebrating the whole suite of less coveted and in many cases less well-known grains and leguminous crops. And also celebrate the wheat, but celebrate them in balance.
So if I had been with you this morning at the Union Square Farmers Market, we would have been, as you say, we would have been walking by some of the great produce that farmers are bringing in. But you would have also been saying, buy that, but also look at that. This is something that a lot of Americans wouldn't think looks especially inviting, or this is something that the farm grows on the other pasture when they're raising that those other yummy vegetables that everybody's flocking around.
Yeah, this morning I bought kohlrabi and kale.
Okay,
now those are things I don't tend to gravitate towards in the middle of the summer, but those are crops that the farm needs to grow because they cannot continue to grow tomatoes and zucchini and corn and peas on the same areas of land. So they're constantly rotating, and they're rotating in other families of crops. In the case of kohlrabi, it's a beautiful crop that breaks up all sorts of disease cycles. It's a natural fumigant. So we need to eat more kohlrabi and more of the kales. That's on a smaller vegetable farm. If you break this out into larger farms where we're really feeding a large number of people and feeding growing interest in this movement, mm-hmm. we need to look at grains and mixed crops because that's where most of our calories come from. Most of agriculture, 65% of agriculture is in grains. About 5% is in vegetables. So while it's important to diversify our vegetable landscape, and the farmer's market is, I think, a very good place to start, we also need to think about this much more broadly and attack the other 65%.
Dan Barber is with us. If you've just tuned in, we're talking about his new book, The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. And at the center of this is an idea of advocating for a food system that's more accommodating of the environment and of the places that are producing our food than demanding of it. As you listen in, and I'm getting a lot of Twitter traffic here, I'll note some of the things that are coming in. I'd like to know if the way you eat has changed significantly as a result of this locavore movement, this attempt to eat more locally with availability and accessibility to local farms in our region here. Are you not only eating more local, are you eating more sustainably, but are you also hearing what Dan is describing here through the third plate? How does that sound? 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter. It's @CarrieNPR. We've got a good discussion going on the Daily Circuit page at nprnews.org. Here's someone, Dan, who tweets from True Cost Farm. They say, we changed our organic hogs to be fed without row crops. The flavor was amazing, much more environmental and sustainable. Can you talk a bit about your experience going out to some of these livestock farms to see how people are doing it?
Well, in the book, I devote a large portion of the book to the Dehesa, which is an area of Spain that produces the great jamón ibérico, the great hams of the world. And those pigs are fed this sort of exquisite and abundant diet based on rotating them throughout the Dehesan landscape, which admittingly has an unfair advantage because they have these 2,000-year-old oak trees that drop these acorns that are fat and tannic and delicious, and the pigs gorge on these in the fall and fatten them up. But the lesson of the Dehesa is a lesson that I think your farmer is alluding to here, which is that we need to get away from an animal agriculture system that looks only to the intensification of row crops, being essentially corn and soybeans, and diversify that diet, that grain diet, where we can add soil fertility. We can produce better tasting wheat and even better tasting corn, cut down on the use of chemical fertilizers and chemical pesticides, and feed our pigs and all of our other animals that are omnivorous, like chickens, a mixed grain diet. It's key because right now the principal ingredient in bag feed is corn or soy. And that does a very effective job of fattening our animals and fattening them quickly and cheaply. But it doesn't do a very good job for looking at the long-term viability of this system as we continue to demand better flavored pigs and pigs for a growing population.
You know, as I understood, though, the third plate philosophy, doesn't that mean that if you live in a place like Minnesota where there are a lot of pigs and hogs grown, we should be eating more pork? I mean, is that kind of the essence of the philosophy?
Well, the essence of the philosophy, in part, it is because the idea is to try and support your local agriculture and your regional agriculture through your diet. But that's not to say that we should be supporting a local regional diet of bad kind of farming.
Okay,
and I'm not singling out Minnesota for particularly bad farming. I'm only suggesting that from what I know of it, and I don't know a lot, but from what I know of it, you know, the intensification of the hog industry in Minnesota is quite large. And the kind of raising of pigs that I'm talking about is much more for the conventional system. And I don't think it speaks to a future where resources are going to become much more fraught, like cheap fossil fuels to grow tremendous amounts of corn and soy that feed the pigs that give us essentially cheap pork. So I'm looking at a system in the future where we are going to be heavily dependent on natural resources to provide our food. And we've got to figure out a farming system and, I think, just as importantly, a diet that supports that natural abundance.
To the phones, to Maggie in Minneapolis. Hi, Maggie. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Second-time caller. Love your show.
Thank you.
I just was calling in because as far as sustainability and future is concerned, my husband and I have decided to do just a little community garden. We have a 2.5-year-old, and her interest in vegetables has taken off simply because every day after daycare, we water, we pick. The conversation when daddy gets home from work is not about TV. It's about we picked a zucchini and we have green beans for dinner. She's interested in eating it all, and not just the perfect tomato, but the bruised tomato. We respect it more, and it's not a perfect something that we got at the grocery store. It's ours. It's bruised. We're going to eat it, and we're excited about it. And the conversation is so exciting, and she's proud of herself. I'm proud of herself, and what we pick is what we eat. And
You're making me hungry just listening to this. You know, what you're articulating, though, is this other very important point, I think, and I'd like to say you're kind of a messenger for the third plate, because that bruised vegetables, those less than perfect looking tomatoes or zucchini, that you're celebrating at the dinner table and your daughter is excited about is a really important concept, because dialing back to an earlier part of this conversation, you asked me about what diversity am I supporting at the farmer's market. You know, one of the things that farmers tend not to bring to the markets are those bruised and damaged tomatoes or zucchini. And the farmer looks at it as a sunk cost, because no one in the right mind is going to buy a damaged zucchini when there's the abundance of perfectly grown, perfectly looking zucchini. And what we need to do as chefs and as people who love to eat, and especially people who have an understanding of this, an agricultural understanding, even if it's a backyard garden, especially if it's a backyard garden, you know the frustrations, you know the challenges of growing in variable weather conditions and all the rest. And we know that vegetables and fruits don't always pick looking like they belong on a coffee table picture book. And that in and of itself is an enormous sunk cost for farmers. It's farmers are always calculating in their yearly projections for what they're gonna take in from the farmer's market or from selling it to supermarkets. They just erase this 20% of their crop. In some cases, it's 30%. Some weather conditions, in the case, it's 30 to 40% of their crop just goes to compost or gets thrown away because it's not able to be sold at the farmer's market. So I've started conversations with the farmers that we support and know quite well, that we get all of this. They're calling it now third plate eggplant. I got this morning, third plate eggplant. What does third plate eggplant look like? It looks like there was a really bad rainstorm and they got pelted. But we're making eggplant puree at the restaurant, wow, at both restaurants
sounds
right now.
Good.
So, and the flavor is fantastic. So you bring up a great point.
From Birchwood Cafe. Oh, yeah, I'm going to be there Saturday night. They say, yes, deeper thinking. It's a cycle, not linear. We like to use, and I think this is Kernza, developed by the Land Institute in Waffles.
Yeah.
Do you know what that is, Dan?
Kernza is a type of wheat that's very exciting. It's the brainchild of a man by the name of Wes Jackson at the Land Institute. And he's a proponent of perennial agriculture, perennial crops, which is that you don't harvest a crop, plow the land, and then replant the next year. You support perennial crops, which don't need to be plowed and replanted. And so Kernza is the first incarnation of years and years and years of research. And it spells another, exactly, it's another third plate idea that you're supporting the true sustainability of land and the true soil fertility, because when you don't plow and replant, you end up keeping nutrients and carbon in the soil, which produces better crops. So Kernza is a look at what's possible for the future.
Dan Barber's here. If you've tuned in, we're talking about the concept behind The Third Plate, a new book. Steph, off the Daily Circuit page.
Nick says, soybeans and alfalfa are far more prevalent soil nitrogen fixers in Minnesota than any of the other specialty crops Dan Barber mentioned, like barley or millet. The industry and markets are set up to support those major nitrogen fixers, and it's not easy for producers to risk planting and producing the specialty crops he mentions. It's an ag challenge.
Well, what about that, Dan?
Yeah, well, I'm not arguing that millet and barley and buckwheat have more nitrogen fixing capacity than soybeans. I'm also not arguing that the market isn't structured from A to Z to support growing soy, and that our government, that our tax dollars also go to support corn and soy from seed to infrastructure. So the comment is exactly right. My only point is to suggest that, first of all, soybeans are, from a leguminous trapping point of view, are a bit of a lazy crop. You can get a lot more nitrogen fixation in the soil from Austrian winterpease, which we grow on our farm and we support in our restaurants. Does that mean there's a market for them? No, not necessarily. But that's sort of the call of the third plate, is that we need to change the culture around the kind of crops that we should be growing for the future of better soil and the future of better flavor. And soybeans should be a part of it, without question. They serve a real purpose from a gastronomic point of view, from a processing point of view. I am aware of the realities of the marketplace. But I'm also suggesting that we as eaters and as chefs need to change the culture around supporting a whole host of other grains that together, not in a singular way, but together in a rotation, in a managed rotation way, provide better soil health for the future.
Chef Craig Sharp from Terra Waconia is tweeting, so proud to be using Elmbrink Farm pasture-raised red wattle pork. And to the phones to Maria in St. Cloud. Hey, Maria, thanks for waiting.
Oh, hi. Nice to talk to you.
You too.
Well, I'm listening on the show, and it's very, very important to understand about how good it is and important to eat fresh. I'm from Brazil, and when I got here in 2007, I was pretty scared about what I found because I could not find what I needed and I was used to cook. And it changed during this 7 years. And I can find, for example, not often, but escargot. That is something that we use a lot. My family is originally from Italy, so we use a lot of grain there in Brazil. Of course, we are a tropical country, but I'm very happy to have this movement of local and fresh. My husband and I, we have a garden at home. We have tons of eggplants that are coming out, and peppers and zucchinis. So I make a lasagna zucchini. So that's what I think that we have to go through, and it's important for me as a Brazilian that used to eat fresh to have all the options here. I'm very happy with the discussion.
I'm really glad to have your call.
You know, one of the things that I learned just dialing to that caller's enthusiasm for what she's finding over these last few years. And by the way, the red wattle pig, which was, I just didn't want to skip over that. Mm. That's an important comment. Red wattle pig is one of my favorite pigs. It has the most delicious flavor. And the interesting thing about that pig is that it's a foraging pig. And so you can't confine a red wattle and feed it corn and soy. It won't work. So one of the benefits of the fat and the flavor from a gastronomic point of view, but one of the other benefits of the red wattle is that it's a free it's the way we used to raise pigs, which is allow them to forage for their own feed to a certain extent, to the extent that you can in your own environment, and supplement that foraging with corn and soy. I think that's a direction for the future that we should be looking to more. But I also wanted to just comment on that the Brazilian diet and what I discovered in the research for this book was that all the great cuisines of the world, all the great patterns of eating that we look to, the French cuisine or Italian cuisine, South American cuisine, they were all negotiations that peasants were doing with the land. I mean, it was essentially about soil fertility. As I dug deeper and deeper, it was about how can we grow the rice if you're in Asia, or the wheat if you're in Europe, or the corn if you're in South American cultures. How can we grow those crops? How can we provide the soil with the right kind of fertility to get us those crops? And largely, that was accomplished through beans. And so in all of these cultures, you have a heavy leguminous crop, to say a crop that transfers that free nitrogen from the air and fixes it into the soil. So you have, you know, Italian and French cuisines are bean cuisines, and you have lentils in India and on and on. And soy plays into that as well. But so does a whole suite of other crops that provide the soil fertility. In Japan, you have buckwheat, and that's why you get soba, and on and on. You look at every cuisine, you see this diversity that provides soil fertility for the coveted crops, but it doesn't allow you, the cuisine itself, which is to say it's dictating your diet because you're part of the culture, it doesn't allow you to demand what the landscape will produce. So the American expectation of a 7-ounce steak for lunch and dinner 7 days a week, or a protein-centric plate of food, a chicken breast, or a hulking piece of fish, centered on the plate with a smattering of vegetables and maybe a little bit of grain or potato is not the kind of architecture for a plate that we need to think about for the future, because the land simply can't support it. And one way to think about the future and create our own architecture is to look at traditional cuisines and how they developed. They developed largely out of hardship, and they developed out of creating soil, natural soil fertility through rotating crops. And that's a lesson I think we could take with us as we think about a delicious future.
If you're listening in, you hear me talking this morning with Dan Barber. He's the author of The Third Plate. And you hear us talking about some of the larger concepts of this. What I don't want to obscure, you can go to the Daily Circuit page to check this out, but that Dan visits some of the places that he's been describing this morning. He goes to Klaas Martin's farm, and he learns about magical soil, and he goes to this area in Spain. It's just wonderful reading about this exploration of people that are really exemplifying the third plate philosophy. So read about it on the Daily Circuit page, and just to give you a sense of what else is in the book. Steph, off the Daily Circuit page.
G. Silver wrote, Mr. Barber is part of the aristocracy of food. Please address the fact that 75% of people cannot afford to eat the foods that he advocates. We already got a response actually from Josh before we hear from Dan Barber.
Okay.
Josh says, I've been broke and now I have a little cash. I eat the same veggies and fruits from my local co-op in both scenarios. You can use your EBT at the co-op. Up, by the way, it takes more time to cook the food, but for the most part, it's always cheaper than eating name brand processed foods out of a box.
And let me grab a call, because I think this kind of follows on what we're hearing off the page, to Rod in Lakeville. Rod, what did you want to bring up?
Yes, I just want to, one of your guests could comment on the opinion of some that the diet he is advocating is elitist and expensive and cannot feed the poor.
Okay. Dan?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know about that. Actually, I think the diet I'm advocating is the democratization of a diversity and an affordable way of eating that ultimately is a lot cheaper than what we're doing now. The affordability of a corn soybean rotation, for example, is heavily subsidized by your tax dollars. It is a chemical system that ultimately denudes the soil and will eventually, as these ecological resources like fossil fuel, but also water, which we haven't talked about, and also constant weather patterns, which are becoming less frequent and less predictable. All of these things call into question the kind of food system we have today and what we end up. Calling a cheap food system. It's only cheap because those costs are externalized. So the third plate, the diet I'm advocating is not for lobster and caviar. What we're talking about is really lowly grains that are quite inexpensive to produce. And while they're inexpensive to produce and they produce good harvests, abundant harvests, they also benefit the soil. So what is a diet that smacks of aristocracy, it seems to me, is the American diet. It's the corn soybean feeding the pigs that ends up being really elitist. And we need to broaden the definition of our expectation for dinner.
You know, in the third plate world, we live in a place where there are long winters. Would we not be eating, let's say, cherries or oranges during the winter because they're grown for the table and not really natural to the area?
Yeah, in a third plate diet for the future, we'd be doing what everyone is moving towards doing, which is celebrating cherries when they're available in late June or early July, depending on your region. And that, I think, is the focus on eating farm to table and eating locally. For eating in a more systematic way, the winters are a great time to celebrate the harvests of the fall, and that's through preserving meat, that's through freezing and canning and pickling. And even if we can just do that for 10% to 20% of our diet for those long winters, that's what we try and aim for in the restaurant is 20% to 30% of what we're serving in the restaurant is from the spring, summer, and fall harvest. That ends up being a lot more delicious, by the way, and a lot more sustainable than the way we are flying food around the country and increasingly around the world.
To the phones here to James in St. Paul. Hi, James. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. I wonder if I can get the guest to comment on I understand the cycle that he's talking about with the mixing animals and different kinds of plants and things, and maybe talk more about how that would reflect in farm policy as well as just sort of how we eat. So, you know, smaller mixed farms or larger mixed farms, or how that would work moving forward.
So, you know, it's a great question, and I've thought about that a lot. I come down sort of always on the conclusion that we need to change the culture of eating. That as Michael Pollan likes to say, we vote with our fork three times a day, and it's a very powerful idea. What I'm calling into question here a little bit more is that we can't just vote with our forks with the tomatoes and zucchini and those cream crops that we tend to covet and expect that the food system will change for the future. But in terms of policy, I feel like policy increasingly will lead off of how our diets change and how the culture changes, that we're not going to get our politicians and we're not going to get the people who can use levers of policy to be ahead of this, because the interests are too large, the diets seem too intractable, and what we really need to do is upend the culture and the expectation that Americans have for a plate of food. And I think the trick, I mean, it's part of the reason that I point to chefs in this book, because I think chefs are these arbiters of taste. They're increasingly icons of culture. It's hard. I don't like calling myself an icon, but we're increasingly culinary icons and cultural icons. And to that extent, we should be creating the kind of architecture on our menu, the kind of architecture for our plates and representing that on our menus that really represents a landscape, a region that celebrates a particular place. And that's where chefs are going right now. I think, you know, it's going to take a couple years to bleed into the culture and inculcate these ideas into the everyday eating. But we're headed in that direction. The focus on better eating is not on eating more expensive products. It's about eating products that celebrate place. And so you're celebrating, you know, vegetables in Southern California, and you're celebrating where I am in the Hudson Valley, grass-fed meats and dairy, because the Hudson Valley was largely built on dairy production. So it's not a one diet to change the American farming system. It's regional celebrations of ecosystems, of landscapes, that end up forcing change. And one way to look, just to be very specific to answer your question, one place to look, and where I point to in the book, is to the mid-sized farmer. You know, we don't talk enough about the mid-sized farmer. We talk a lot about the small family farmer that's packing up, you know, the pickup truck and selling to us at the farmer's market. And we talk a lot about the corn and soybean farmers that are 10,000 acres in Iowa that get all the federal subsidies and increasingly are getting larger and larger. But what we don't talk about are the people in the middle. And these still represent, by varying degrees, somewhere around 40% of our agriculture is what is termed agriculture of the middle. And these are farmers that are too large to pack up a pickup truck and deliver it to the farmer's market, but they're too small increasingly to play in the Walmartification of the food system. And these are farmers that have acreage. You know, I point to one in the book. It's about 2,000 acres, Klaus Martens, that is nimble enough to diversify their crops. And he grows a lot of corn and soybeans, for sure, and makes a lot of money growing them. But he's diversifying because he's forced to get the soil fertility. And he's, through connections with chefs like me and others, creating markets for these crops that end up being a lot healthier for his soil. I think that's the ticket to the future, is look to the farmers that are nimble enough to change. If you're growing 10,000 acres of corn-soy rotations, you have no interest and no impetus to change your ways and your machinery, from seed to machinery, to farm machinery, to harvest, to elevator, to distributor. You're locked into a system that's going to be very hard to change until the culture changes. So I point to mid-sized farmers because I think they are an exciting place in agriculture that's long been ignored.
Dan Barber's book is called The Third Plate: Field Notes on the Future of Food. Your enthusiasm shines through, Dan. Thanks so much for the time this morning.
Thank you.
And we'll keep the conversation going on the Daily Circuit page.
We will. Matt says that he's got lots of kales at his CSA varieties he's never seen at the local grocery store.
All right. Is that, did you say kale?
Kale.
Kale.
Your favorite.
This is the Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News.